Fusion Patrol is brought to you in part by our patrons at patreon.com/fusionpatrol. We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight we are looking at Space 1999, episode, we're going to call it 3, Black Sun. Alpha is tense as they prepare for a near miss from an asteroid. Suddenly, the asteroid changes to a collision course with Alpha, but then it moves off again and is destroyed for no apparent reason. Looking out the side window, they are shocked to discover a huge black circle hanging over them, almost like a hole in space with lots and lots of gravity, but black, really black, as if no light could escape it. What could it be?
Grit.
Professor Bergman does his sums while Koenig sends a reconnaissance eagle to study the phenomena. When the eagle gets too close, it is pulled in by the massive gravity and torn apart, almost like spaghetti. What could this strange, high-gravity, hole-like, black phenomena be? Bergman arrives at the answer. It's a black sun. Really? A black, not like a black, I don't know, a hole or something like that. It's a black sun. All right, never mind. They're all going to be sucked into the black sun and die. Unless Bergman does something incredibly clever, which he does. He builds a gravity screen from Alpha's anti-gravity towers. The canceling forces will cause the shield to protect them using the very power of the black sun that threatens them. Except, it won't. It's all a lie concocted by Koenig and Bergman to keep morale up as they all die their inevitable death. Except for 6 people who will be sent off into space in a survival ship to die alone in space 5 weeks later after their food runs out. When Alan Carter discovers Koenig is building a survival ship, he gets all stereotypically Australian hot-headed. He demands a place on the survival ship. Koenig shuts him down and then announces the computer-selected list of people best suited to survive. Alan was chosen as the pilot, and he looks a right melon for being such a jerk in front of everybody. Way to go, Alan. The survival ship departs. The remaining Alphans settle in to die. As Koenig and Bergman drink brandy and talk philosophy, they plunge into the black sun. Weird things happen. They age, and they talk with a friendly cosmic intelligence, and then they emerge halfway across the universe with everything returned to normal. Even the survival ship, now halfway across the universe, somehow arrives back at Alpha. The Alphans, like the audience at home, all ponder the question, what the hell just happened? Okay, so, Black Sun. Black Sun. So, an interesting premise for an episode of TV show. We spent 45 minutes watching people wait to die. What did you think of this episode?
Well, I kept thinking back. You know, actually, I was considering this today. I watched this last night, took my notes, and I was considering this today, and thought how when we reviewed Matter of Life and Death, I kept thinking that it was just. It was metaphysical claptrap, and I really hated the episode back then when I watched it, and I hated it now. And here we have another episode of metaphysical claptrap. I loved the episode then, and I still love the episode now.
It's an interesting thing because
it is.
Here we have basically you're going to die, and whereas they have been in this sort of we might die any moment kind of thing, here's the inevitability staring you in the face out the starboard window, and we get to see how they deal with it and how their training kicks in, and it just really is. It's just not something that you would. It's not a kind of drama thing you would normally expect to see. Sort of
no.
Space 1999, waiting to die.
Yeah, and that's part of what I found fascinating with the episode. Now that the Eagle has gone off, power consumption has been dropped to a minimum, if just not downright non-existent. And to see how they react, you've got people playing chess. You've got some playing poker. Paul is busy playing the guitar. He's getting lucky while serenading with the guitar.
I think he is. I'm not sure. It's kind of hard to tell in that scene, but I'm thinking Paul may have gotten lucky there at the last minute.
He just might have, because he and Sandra are not a thing yet. Whoops, I'm sorry, I just jumped the timeline.
But at the same time, he did actually put the moves on her.
Well, hey, Michael's dead.
Yeah, Michael's dead, the guy we've never heard of before, but he's dead. And he apparently had something to do with Sandra. So I think it was her brother. That's why she fainted when he died. I don't know.
That's your story and you're sticking to it.
I'm sticking to it, yeah.
Okay.
I did think it was kind of weird that Paul decided to go along for the ride with Sandra. It's just a weird gesture. I'm not sure. I don't want to say what he was trying to get out of it, because obviously he wasn't expecting to get anything out of it.
No, it might have been just simple compassion.
Because
she lost somebody that was close to her, whether Michael was her brother, whether it was her boyfriend, husband, whatever. Obviously, he was somebody that was very important to her. And Paul and Sandra worked very closely together, quite literally, in Main Mission.
Mm-hmm.
So I would imagine that they must have worked together for some time, even before the episode, where they get blown out of the solar system. So he kind of gets a good read on her just by watching her all the time. And, I think a lot of, when you work in any kind of work environment, and you're working with some of the same people time in and time out, I mean, there will be some sort of a familial kind of relationship that will develop. And I'm sure Paul felt something that was purely good regarding Sandra. I mean, he genuinely cared for her. I don't think that he was going along for the ride just in the hopes of getting some nookie-nookie. But
not with 3.5 minutes to
not with three off, and a half yeah. minutes. I mean, no. I mean, there's especially with all those, with all the heavy clothing they're going to be wearing, and they got to be taking off in the Eagle. I mean, there's no real time for a wham bam thank you ma'am. So I think he just simply went along just to be of good support to Sandra. That will, I believe, serve him in the future as they will get closer. I'm jumping the timeline. Yes, I know. But as for now, I think he just did it because he just wanted to be a good friend to her. That's cool.
Yeah, we do get to see how the people react under different situations. But yeah.
But the ones that I enjoy watching the most are Koenig and Bergman, especially Bergman.
Bergman's really
enjoyable in this one. I enjoy him a lot because even though he knows – well, he doesn't – I mean he's got this 90%+ certainty that they're going to die. I mean there's still the tiny possibility. Yeah, this whole anti-grav shield thing, yeah, that was largely a bluff. But it was based obviously – I mean he based on some kind of scientific principle. So I wouldn't be surprised if maybe somewhere he thought, well, maybe it might work. Because they did keep coming back to if the shields hold. They keep throwing that out every now and then. So they weren't completely throwing in the towel and saying, we're all going to die. And at the same time, Bergman just kept coming back with, whatever's going to happen, I hope it's interesting.
Yeah, he was an interesting character throughout the entire episode. The only thing that I felt was weird, and I thought it was weird the first time I watched the episode, and thought it was weird the 10th time I watched the episode, when he has had his medical emergency and he wakes up in the medical center.
And then we find out.
Is he supposed to be stoned? Because
I don't know.
He's like,
The whole thing was kind of weird.
Yeah. I mean, okay, we find out about the mechanical heart. And that's
okay. We've never heard that before. I mean, okay.
Well, you hit the point
just out of the blue. Yeah, but
it was such a mechanical heart. Boop, there you go.
It was a weird time to be introduced to that as far as the story element goes. I mean, Yeah, he gets a nice bit of an electric shock as one of the antigrav towers just goes kablooey. It was odd. It felt a little unnecessary. Maybe that was a little bit of padding. I'm not sure. I don't know what the point of that little story element
had to have
was.
A little action. Need some explosion.
I suppose. I mean, this is T in interstellar space, I suppose. So maybe ITV.
Somebody. Yeah.
Yeah, the ITV execs were thinking, it's a bit boring. You don't want tea in the Midlands again, or this tea in the Milky Way. We can't have that. No, we need some action. Okay, we'll fry Bergman. How's that?
Okay, that's good then. Put that in.
Oh, yeah. We can't kill him. Oh, I know. He'll have a mechanical heart. How's that?
Yeah, and I'm not even sure that... I don't think the mechanical heart... how do I phrase this? I think I read somewhere once upon a time some character sketches. And, you know, that's one of the things that was just always written in there for Bergman, actually, was that he had a mechanical heart. And you don't have many times to use that in a script. So it's just possible that the writers all knew he had a mechanical heart, and when they had this situation, then that was their opportunity to say, hey, you know, you wouldn't have survived if you hadn't been for the mechanical heart. I don't know. I know it shows up again.
Yeah, it does. I remember it does come up one more time. I cannot remember the occasion, but yes,
I can't
it
remember
does
the
happen.
Episode. I remember what the occasion is on it, but I can't remember the episode. But we'll get to that when that happens, I suppose. Anyway, yeah, he was interesting, and his little bit where he's talking about, well, first off, there's the line where Koenig says to Helena, who knows what Victor really thinks, as if the man is a complete mystery to him, even though he's obviously his old friend.
Yeah, I kind of got the take on that, and this is weird. My initial impression was, what, you think Victor's like lying to you or keeping things from you?
I don't know. And then there's another scene where Victor comes in, he says, you know, John, I've been giving some thought to stuff. And then he walks over to the window and he starts looking out the window. And Koenig's response was, Victor.
Yeah.
Kind of very impatient, sort of like, you're
at it. We're all going to die. You might as well get it out. Okay.
But yeah, it was a very odd. And then, of course, when he came back, he says, you know, I've tried to calculate the odds and it's darn near infinite against the surviving. And, you know, what do you think? And how do you think that happened? And Koenig's like, you're not talking about God, are you? And Bergman's very quick to say, I don't know, I'm a scientist. I don't know anything about God, but I think he's like a cosmic intelligence. And I'm
like, okay, that's another word for God. Okay, let's be real.
You know, that's right. That's one way to look at it. There are people who would debate that, but yeah, right. And
although it could be said that there is a very advanced being that lives, you know, that's so unbelievably vast, in the universe, that maybe, I mean, it's not God per se, and that it's not the creator of life, but it is a very benevolent life form out there. I mean, I suppose it's possible.
It's just kind of the way he postulates it. It's almost like, and there's a line at the end of the episode too. He's talking about the force field. When I watch the episode, as I go through it, I think he's just sort of like, you know, how the heck did we do it? We're going to die, of course, obviously. But, you know, how did we make it this far? Is this something that helped us along the way? And Koenig kind of like, this idea. And then they're in the Black Sun, and they talk to, unless it's a hallucination, they talk to the being that's out there, and then they cough up the other side. And Koenig's like, well, so much for your ideas of some cosmic intelligence.
Well,
there, Bergman.
But that's like, only when the eagle wasn't showing up on their scanners. Koenig thought that, well, if the cosmic intelligence is going to get us through on the other side, then it'll help deliver our six people back.
I'm thinking that if the entire moon got shot halfway through to the other side of the galaxy and survived going through a black sun, and it talked to you that you would not be a doubting Thomas at this point about a cosmic intelligence, whether or not it brought the other. Because remember, Michael's still dead. It didn't save everybody in this little fiasco. Yeah. It didn't suck him through the hole and shoot him out the other side. So it's not like, you know, okay, we gambled, we sent you the wrong way, you didn't fall into the black hole, you didn't get survived. Koenig should feel bad that he sentenced those people to a certain starving, horrible death on board the Eagle, but he should have felt bad about that anyway.
This is one of the areas that I have a problem with the episode. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that it's perfect. I mean, there are I love this episode, I would say, you know, 80%. But there are things on here that I really, really take great umbrage with. And the idea of, you know, this cosmic intelligence that was protecting them and whatnot. And, of course, my first thought that runs through my head is, okay, if cosmic intelligence slash God, call it whatever you want to call it. I mean, if it's watching you out all this time – watching out for you all this time, then why didn't it watch out for you and stop the moon from being blown out of Earth's orbit?
Maybe we'll get an answer to that.
Oh, I highly doubt it.
I guess what I was getting at was that Bergman is just kind of throwing the idea out there before they go through the black sun. Then we encounter the thing. Then Koenig's kind of doing the little dismissive bit. But the way he says it, it's like, you know, they're looking for the Eagle. And it's like he's talking to Bergman as if, and you were expecting a cosmic intelligence to save us.
Yeah. It did, yeah, there was something a little.
I didn't get that from Bergman's pre-black hole experiences.
No, I just thought
he was kind of like, you know, we're going to die, but have you ever wondered why we aren't dead
yet? We're still alive up to this point?
Yeah. And, you know, and it's a great question at the end when Koenig is going, and I really do – at times, I really am impressed with Martin Landau's acting. And I know it's a simple thing, but the tear that he managed to pull, the not tear per se, but the sort of glistening eye that he managed to pull out with, we're actually still alive, without being hysterical, and yet at the same time, I mean, that's clearly an incredibly emotional moment.
It's very, very subtle acting, and sometimes the subtle acting is the one that's what really stands out. You know, less is more.
But there they go.
Yeah, it's great.
Your shield held, and Bergman's response is, "I wonder why," because he knew it wasn't going to work, and yet they've just seen the cosmic intelligence, and so again, you should sort of be thinking that maybe they helped you. It helped you? I don't know. There's this kind of, you saw it with your own eyes, but you still don't quite seem to believe what happened to you. It's a little weird, but then at the same time, Space 1999 has always had some weird ideas about science and computers. Like in this episode, what the heck was all that stuff with Kano and the computers?
Yeah, well, I think Kano has a love affair with the computer, to be honest.
Yes, but then basically Koenig was being a jerk to him. And we'll just have to think for ourselves. It's like, hey, old Koenig boy, you'd be dead in vacuum without that computer. So I think you need to reassess what's important there. And the fact that you've got some sort of anti-silicon intelligence bias going on there is unacceptable. I don't know. It's like there was a almost, both Bergman and Koenig had an almost anti-computer attitude. Like Bergman, when he's confirming the calculations, is basically in a way he's complaining at the computer when it's verifying his numbers or failing to verify its numbers, or then when it does verify his numbers and it starts to say, hey, you need to go tell the commander, and he's like, yeah, I'm way ahead of you. Like, mm-hmm. It was there is that sort of anti-technological streak there, and I guess, you know, sometimes you run the risk in shows like Star Trek where you tech the tech too much, and kind of a lot of times technology is going to solve your problems. Space 1999, a lot of times it seems like they think, whether it is or not, that the technology could be a problem, and yet, you know, they rely on it for everything that they do and survive on. So it's a different attitude. It's a different attitude across the board there. So a couple questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
First off, when the asteroid swung by the moon, why did it shudder? Just wondering about that. I mean, did it, like, whoosh it with the air over the moon or something that caused the whole moon to shake?
And given the size of it, it would not have any kind of significant gravitational force as to affect anything on the moon at that point.
I wouldn't think so, no.
No, it was big enough to cause damage. Yeah, yeah, I mean, it was big enough to cause some serious damage if it were to impact, but not big enough to do anything else.
So here we are. We're in space, and you're having a tense moment because you're tracking an asteroid that's coming in at your kind of near your moon, and you've got all the computers and the sensors and everything, and you're scanning the skies, and you're worried about this, and then it zips by, and then Koenig goes, "Huh, switch on the starboard camera," and then they pop up this massive whacking great thing in encompassing the entirety of the sky. You're telling me they didn't see that?
At some point, they should have.
The little tiny asteroid coming at us, but we did not notice the giant black hole. Sorry,
I would imagine
not gonna say black hole.
It's a black hole. I mean, I remember when they kept talking about it. You know, black sun. Okay, are you saying it's a black hole? Or are you saying it's a neutron star? I'm not sure which, but based on finally what Koenig said, you know, how physics and time turns sort of inside out when you're inside the thing. I'm like, okay, you're talking about a black hole. Let's be real. Stop calling it a black sun. In any case, I would imagine that they would be having their cameras doing practically a 360 as they go barreling on through space.
Or looking out the windows that are all over main mission.
Yeah. I mean, they should not have missed it. I mean, even much further away, they should have seen something that's kind of, oh, isn't that a pretty nebula? Why is there a black circle in the middle of it?
Uh-huh. Yeah. It was all kind of weird. But, yeah. Anyway, let's see. What else? Did you notice that the switches on the Eagle were Zener cards? They were the symbols from ESP tests.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, if you watch the beginning when Mike's going to say, all right.
I saw him pushing, but I just did not make that connection that they were supposed to be the symbols for ESP tests. It just didn't click.
Yeah, so...
That's interesting.
It's interesting they chose those symbols. It's like maybe they had them lying around the studio and they just cut them out. So this look interesting. Stick them on the buttons.
I kind of wonder if those things are going to make another appearance some point down the road.
I was very pleased with James when we were watching this, because he's watching the episode. They've not called it a black hole. They're just calling it the black sun. Well, they hadn't even called it a black sun at that point. They hadn't. And
until Bergman gets all his numbers in a row.
That's after the Eagle blows up.
Yeah.
And the Eagle's all swirling around in that weird sort of thing before it blows up. And James goes, nice spaghettification.
Wow.
I was really impressed that he
pulled that
out.
You were proud.
I was. I was proud of that. It's like, he knows what he... I mean, he's... Obviously, we've heard the term before, but he remembered it, and he used it in its correct term, even though that's not probably what it would look like. it was pretty good. Let's see. What else do we have? So, the shield. The mm-hmm. Bergman Force Shield. Did you notice that they described the eight towers around Alpha as with anti-gravity generators?
Yes. And these were the generators that helped give the G1 force inside Moonbase, apparently.
How exactly do you generate... Not saying how do you generate gravity, but what exactly is generating anti-gravity going to do to get you... Assuming that there is such a thing as anti-gravity as opposed to gravity, how does that get you to 1G?
That is a great question. I will give them half a point for at least trying to come up with some kind of explanation as to why there's regular gravity inside Moonbase, but whenever you see them outside, they're all just kind of like floating, like we've seen in all the NASA photos, NASA vids and things like that.
If it were towers that were generating a field, then it would be outside too, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it should be within that field,
within those towers,
within the diameter, or not diameter, but you know what I mean, the entire area that those towers circle. Like I said, I'm only giving them half a point for at least trying to come up with an explanation, poor as it was. I mean, I can see how it works in terms of explanation of the Bergman shield and the purpose it's going to serve. But as far as creating Earth-like gravity inside moon base, no.
See, now all that doesn't fly. On the moon base is they have special shoes that weigh a lot. Because there is gravity on the moon, obviously. It's just about, I think, one-third of Earth's gravity. So if they just had, you know, shoes that weighed 150 pounds, Earth weight, then you'd be fairly normal. Pretty straightforward.
I could see that. But even everything else...
Except when you're lying in bed
at
night.
But there's also the objects that they hand each other.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, those are made of special heavyweight alloys, too.
I would assume also, like, you know, the human bodies, you know, like when Bergman is flung back from being electrocuted.
That explains why they fling quite well on Alpha. Think about it. Of course, he'd have his shoes dragging, but...
Yeah, this explanation isn't really working.
But it's still a little better than anti-gravity towers.
Yeah.
I think they just thought that sounded cool. They probably thought anti-gravity towers sounded cooler than gravity towers, and there you go. So, I will tell you this. I had to do a little research. The term black hole was mm-hmm. coined in 1967.
Right.
So they should have known about it.
Of course they should have known about it.
Scientist John A. Wheeler coined that in 67. So at some sort of a symposium. So, you know, I could have forgiven him if it had popped up and they said, well, yeah, the term popped around in 1974. And we go, see, at this point they were just making stuff up. But now they
no, I mean, it was.
Admittedly, that's only 6 years.
Yeah, but it was still there. And it would – I can't imagine them even writing this kind of a story premise and not know the theory behind it.
Yeah. Just Google it, guys. When you're writing a story like this, just Google it. It's all it takes. How about Alan Carter?
Ugh. Putz.
Wow. He really did not come off well in this episode.
He hasn't. Well, this is our
second in a row where he hasn't come off very well.
No, well, hey, well,
maybe third.
I'm going to say third. He didn't come off well in the first episode either. I mean, he's just not coming off well. Period. I mean, he's really coming off. I mean, I've never really heard of any kind of a stereotype about cranky Australians, but if there is one, you know, you look it up, and it'll, you know. If you were to get the Encyclopedia Britannica and look up cranky Australian, there will be Alan Carter.
Yeah, he's really a jerk.
But it's something about Nick Tate. I mean, he's just like that in every role he plays.
And yet, Alan is—I hate to say it—but he's a well-loved character. And
I think he eventually warms up down the road. I think finally. People begin to they don't find him quite so antagonizing. That's my memory as the series goes on. So maybe that's why he's so beloved, because they remember how he becomes, not how he started. I'm guessing.
It could be. Well, so what do you think? He thought that Koenig was ditching them?
That was my thought, that he thought Koenig was going to be the one to take off in the Eagle. You know, which
I haven't told anybody. That's because I'm leaving.
Yeah, because I'm a spineless commander, and I have no wish to go down with the moon.
Yeah, that's how it comes off. And of course, it's this go around. It was like, did you know? Did you know? And of course, most of the people are saying no, including Kano, which has to be a lie.
Yeah, because if these names were fed into the computer. Kano would have had to have been aware of it at some point.
Right, and we know Paul knew about it because he was. He was organizing it, and presumably everyone who put the Eagle up on the pad, everyone who was stocking the Eagle, all the people doing the supply pulls, and basically almost everyone on Alpha should have known about this damn thing. It was completely not did not come off as if it was a secret until Alan comes barging in to me. Hey, you? Did you think he was keeping it a secret?
You got me thinking now.
I mean, he never announced it to the crew. That's
no,
true.
He never did.
Not until the end, but I mean, he announces it to Helena when he says, you know, the only way anybody's going to survive is if we send it off. But, like I say, you see Dr. Matthias, you see crewmen stalking the Eagle. He saved one Eagle behind. The Eagle technician crews must have known that. They put it up on the pad. Somebody had to put it up on the pad. You'd think Alan would have figured it out from that point, since he's in charge of that kind of stuff. It just never occurs to me until he barges in that that had been a complete secret. I can totally see a legitimate argument that says, you know, we know this field's a long shot. We're going to split up and see what we can do, despite the fact that that's a far worse bet, I think.
Yeah, you know, that's the other thing that kind of really weirds me out. And I have a really weird feeling about this, and that is the sending off of the Eagle with the six people. Now, on one hand, I can understand why somebody would want to send off loved ones in a lifeboat, you know, because that's essentially what the Eagle is. It's a lifeboat at this point, in the hopes that they will find sanctuary or and some kind of safety and be able to live out their lives. But they're out in interstellar space.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, I mean, this is only the third episode. We really have no idea how far they've traveled at this point. No uh-huh. clue. But assuming that it's sort of happening in real time, well, they're 3 weeks out, they'd still be in the solar system. Okay, let's ignore that science for now. Right. But so far, it's not been an entirely great experience.
Mm-hmm. They haven't had any luck yet.
No.
Why would they think an eagle with 5 weeks of food, you know, heading off in a random direction is going to get lucky? I mean, yes,
yeah.
The eagle can pick its direction. That's different from the moon. So I guess they can point at a star and go, we'll just get there with our regular propulsion rocket engines, not our warp drive. Yeah.
Yeah, but I keep thinking, you know, given the circumstances, I don't know. Part of me keeps wondering why they were sent out in the first place. Part of me says, don't send them out. Let them stay.
Mm-hmm.
But there's that other part of me that's saying, well, but if, you know, if a ship is sinking, you know, you obviously want to send out your loved ones if you can on a lifeboat because they'll have a chance for survival, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm very, very torn by this. But still, there's that part of me that just nags and says that
when?
It makes no sense that they would be sent out. I mean, especially if it's only six people. But then again, this episode is also very unusual because it really seems to imply or it states the idea that there's not very many people on Alpha.
Well, no. But so you give the concept there of sending out your loved ones, and there's a scene where it's sort of obvious that Koenig is not going to let Helena not go on the ship because it's important to me. His words. I mean, it's not the most sappy or emotionally overdrawn scene ever, but it does. It drives the point. So here's my question: did the computer really pick the list, or did Koenig just say that the computer picked the list so he could get Helena on the shuttle? Because otherwise, why wouldn't it be Bob Matthias turns out to be the better choice according to the computer for a doctor? And some other woman could have filled in elsewhere.
Like,
it seems awfully convenient that the person Koenig wants to save gets on the shuttle.
Well, unless you're trying to also create the equivalent of an arc.
Well, that's what the impression I got from it. I mean, that's what he kind of implies when he says the computer has picked these six people to be, you know, three men, three women, to be the best choice for mankind to survive in space.
Yeah.
And, you know, Helena's a little past her prime for breeding stock, so is it because they just needed a really first-class doctor? Or is it because Kano didn't know about the list because he told Alan he didn't know anything about the survival ship. So therefore, where did Koenig get the list? Or did Koenig make it up? And that way he could sneak Helena on board there.
Yeah, that's a good question. I took it at face value.
So did I. I did. Until you started talking about, you know, sending your loved ones out. Because, you know, the six people could be six people Koenig hates. Like Alan.
Well.
It's like I'm going to put Alan on the ship now. Jerk. let me rewrite that list here just real quick.
I believe we're supposed to.
Alan's their best pilot.
Yeah, Alan is their best pilot. That is without any question. But I was always under the impression that Koenig and Alan were friends for, at least have been friends for some time.
I get that impression too. It's just, you know, seems like Alan's kind of a hard guy to stay on the good side of. The second he thinks you're maybe running out like a rat, he just jumps to the conclusion that you're. You know, Bergman knows he's not going. Helena knew he wasn't going to go. I mean, they even had that scene where he said, you knew he wasn't going to go. And Helena, like, nods her head. Yeah, I knew he wasn't going to go because he's not that kind of guy. But we've seen that time and time again. He's not that kind of guy. I don't know why, if Alan's an old friend of his, why he would even remotely think of that. Or, and maybe that's not what he's thinking. Maybe he's just thinking he's going to put six people on there and I didn't get a chance to put my name in the hat or something. But nonetheless, Alan doesn't come off well.
No, he comes off very poorly. He really does.
And then, think about this. Think about this. The filthy swine, right? poor Paul, right? Here's his chance. Finally, the woman he loves, Sandra, has lost her boyfriend. But now she's leaving forever, so he takes her on the tube, and, you know, to the thing and says goodbye to her in totally unrequited love, and there's Alan Carter giving him the thumbs up. Thanks, Paul. Because you have to take that into consideration from the six people on this ship. It's an arc. If they get somewhere, they have to breed, or the human race dies. So that thumbs up seems kind of, I'm still being a jerk. Thanks, Paul. I'll take good care of her for you.
Yeah. But, you know, I didn't look at it that way, but I tell you, I will not be able to watch this episode the same way again now. Thank you.
You're welcome. The whole survival ship thing,
it's
just a bad idea.
It's a terrible idea, but now I'm looking at the personalities involved. It's like, oh my God, especially Alan. I mean, he really is coming off as just a horrible human being here.
Hey, Sandra, would you like to ride up front in a cockpit with me?
Hey, say Sandra, there's more than one reason why they call it a cockpit.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Well, we've taken Space 1999 and
ran into the gutter.
Up until this point, no one had ever shipped Space 1999 ever in the history of mankind.
Yeah, I think we've ruined the episode for everybody, including myself.
You know, my question is, how does the Eagle get away? Since they're obviously far past the point where Michael got trapped and couldn't escape.
Yeah.
Well, we'll just so now, one of the things that's a complaint leveled against Space 1999 is that the characters are overly serious, that the situations are dark, that things don't always make sense. And yet, I love the scene. Well, first off, the way the scene starts off, I kind of hate it. With Helena sitting there going, no, in her utterly emotionless and way.
In her Botox way?
Yeah. When I was a little girl, I used to be afraid of the dark. Isn't that funny? It's like, well, no, that's...
Well, you're not selling it.
That's not funny. And then Sandra turns to her and says, and I used to be afraid of doctors. Now, that's funny.
Yeah. That's called irony.
That's a great line. And it's like, wow, somebody did interject humor in this episode. It's just, there's not much anywhere along the way. Little bit. Even when they get to the scene where Bergman pulls out his cigar, right? It's almost a comical scene, or it looks like it has the potential, like when John goes, Victor, you're not supposed to be smoking. Which, on a moon base, yes, you're not supposed to be smoking, but tell that to UFO and Shadow Base.
Yeah. But I think that's also the whole thing of Bergman's health. I mean, he's got the mechanical heart. So obviously it's a health issue because, you hear him reply, I don't think Helena would mind.
Well, see, that's exactly the point. It's like, it looks like it's going to be this little kind of comic-y bit where you're going, hey, Victor, that's not good for your health. Neither's fallen into a black sun, John. It's like, oh yeah, ha ha, let's get drunk then. I mean, there's that kind of, well, so what? You're going to die. It's then when he goes, well, I don't think Helena would, and then it all goes somber again. Oh yeah. So anything that was going to kind of build up into a little bit of light in that is crushed.
It was crushed at that moment. Yeah.
That moment.
Yeah.
So it was.
I mean, it really. Yeah. There's that. Yeah. It would have been more hilarious, for. Yeah.
Maybe hilarious.
You're expecting
a little bit overexciting, but
we're going to die, and you're worried about me smoking a stogie.
Exactly. Or the fact that it might cause a fire, or burn down some of the plastic, or something like that. Yeah. All of those things. Yeah, at that point, there is that whole sort of fatalistic kind of, it's not like it's going to do me any permanent harm, is it? And yet, they managed to turn that into a something else moment.
Yeah, not somber, but geez, I don't know what kind of moment it is, but it's one that was, I felt it was unnecessary, seriously, at that point. I would have liked it if they had kept it funny, kept it light.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with them, they're having 60-year-old brandy. They're just having a really otherwise a very nice conversation about what they're going to be facing. Victor's being scientifically optimistic, with I hope it's interesting kind of thing. Yeah, it's a really great moment. I think it's one of my favorite moments in the entire episode. And then to have that whole thing, I really don't think Helena would mind at this point. It's like, okay, there's a splash of cold water on you.
There is that scene where they dismiss Paul and two of them sit on the step and they're both cold and they've got the brandy and it pulls back and you have the empty base. And there really is that sort of, there's a very fatalistic sort of, we're just sitting here waiting to die. We're so small in this universe, and it's very well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's beautifully written, beautifully shot, beautifully directed. It's a rather intimate scene, which gives the episode a lot of substance to it in terms of its characters. I mean, it's at that point, I think that scene is more character driven than plot driven. It's just a great moment.
I think what cinches it for me is Bergman's pulling out the brandy, and he's 60-year-old brandy, and he's I've been saving this for a celebration. Most people wouldn't think this is a celebration, but to me it is, and that's his, quest for new experiences and scientific knowledge, I think, is how that comes off to me. It's like, this is a grand adventure, and of discovery, he can't do anything with it. He's taking it. And Koenig cheers him to everything that might have been. And Bergman's no to everything that was. Celebrate the life that you had, the time that you had, the experiences, not to the, it's the optimist and the pessimist there.
It is.
They're completely diametrically opposite thoughts. And Bergman is taking the put a positive spin on it. Koenig, stop whining. He doesn't say that, but
but that's kind of the tone that he's sort of taking. I mean, Bergman's a scientist, although we do find out that Koenig's not a slouch either, because I guess he has a sort of a gravitational unified field theory. Yeah.
Well, I think everyone on Alpha is supposed to be
some kind of scientific background.
And I guess they're probably the top of the top,
too. I would imagine.
So, yeah. I think yeah, that was a very interesting. And then Bergman's line about that thing. One thing I learned is just the difference, the line between science and mysticism.
And that, see, now we get
just a line.
It's. I mean, at this point, there's a lot of philosophy.
He's just talking nonsense there. I mean, well, I love Bergman, but he is just basically talking. You know, whatever you want to believe, that's probably reality anyway. And I mean, he's really kind of
he's kind of
out there.
He's gone from pure science, and now he's gone into the realm of philosophy. He's philosophizing at this point. And a lot of philosophers are doing that. You know, well-educated philosophers that have a background in science. I mean, there's a lot of them. I've read a lot of books on these, on some of their ideas, and they do try to blend mysticism and science, and try to pose the idea that they might very well be two sides of the same coin. I mean, when you look at the word mysticism, you know, it's really the root of that is mystery. Mysticism is something we just don't understand.
I saw a quote, and I can't remember where it was. I mean, I can't remember who it was sourced from, but it was something that sums up my problem with science as it's frequently portrayed in television and movies and fiction. I mean, we've talked about this. Frankenstein has a lot to answer for. Science isn't a belief system. Science is...
It's empirical fact.
No, science is a methodology.
It's scientific research.
Science is a methodology. That is what its goal is to do. It is
the pursuit of...
Through a certain... Yes. And that's kind of... It frequently gets... and it's being confused here for a belief system, I guess. You know, mysticism. I believe in science. It's like, I don't believe in science. I believe that science is a process that can help you arrive at factual information or
True.
Tested information. And so, I kind of fundamentally have a problem with Bergman's assertion there that they are two sides of the same coin. But you're right. There are lots of philosophers who try to take that tack. I'm not necessarily convinced by their arguments, but they have degrees in philosophy, so they must know what they're talking about. But
when you get into that kind of area, you know, and I don't want to veer off the episode too much, but I'm simply saying this in terms of, you know, the character's defense and Bergman's defense. You know, when you get into that area, I mean, you know, philosophy, that's right up there with like opinion. It's a personal viewpoint. There's no universal right or wrong on that. I mean, with science, there is up to a point. You know, the universal right or wrong, it can be established based on how far we have come in that pursuit of truth and understanding in the universe and everything around us. When you pull in the philosophy element, yeah, then it gets to be it gets very nebulous.
Isn't the difference between what's a fact and what's right? You know, right as in not as in correct. I mean, this is either a fact or it's not a fact. That's what you're trying to derive out of science. And
correct.
In philosophy, you're trying to come up with what is truth, what is right and wrong, what is – and those are subtly different things from what is fact and
yeah.
what is fiction.
And because each person has a different moral set, they will come to – different conclusions. So therefore, when you have you know, 10 different philosophers who have some sort of an education in science as well, you know, they're going to come up with 10 different viewpoints. I mean, there might be some similarities here and there, but they're not all going to be identical.
I had always heard that if you had an infinite number of philosophers and an infinite number of typewriters, you would eventually...
Don't tell me you're going to get the works of Shakespeare because I'm going to hit you.
No, you'd get some gibberish. You might get the works of Shakespeare too. I don't know. Anyway, we cannot. Let's talk about it. We can't leave this episode without the big elephant in the room.
Oh, the cosmic intelligence or what?
The whole
inside.
I think
the
we're going to try to do the 2001 experience here on Alpha. People becoming transparent, lots of lights, blinky stuff. mysteriously getting old and craggy for no apparent reason. It's very trippy, and
yeah.
Someone
dropped some acid when they wrote the episode, you know. And the funny thing is, none of this actually bothers me. I kind of, you know, I don't firmly believe that's what would happen as we approached a black hole. I mean, even if you did have some sort of anti-grav protection that would prevent the spaghettification, but at the same time, you know, we get little hints as to where this is going to go. I mean, earlier on, you have Koenig telling Helena that physics and, you know, time and, you know, those all just get turned inside out inside of there, you know, inside the black sun. They don't know what's going to happen. You know, obviously the writers don't know what's going to happen. So now they're just kind of they're like, you know, okay, well, I mean, now if we were to write something along those lines, and I'm completely chucking Disney's Black Hole because that was the worst movie ever made.
Okay, but I was going to bring that up because it's been a very, very, very long time since I saw Black Hole in the cinema when it first came out. But I seem to recall that when they plunged into the black hole, then it was all like, I don't know, hell or something.
It did. It got very Catholic, almost.
There is this sort of, well, we don't know what's happening, so we're just going to sort of, as you say, drop some acid and write some stuff down. And it comes back to the Space 1999 thing. It's like, we don't know what happened. We leave the episode not knowing what happened. And sometimes that can leave the audience cold and behind. And obviously this one I feel is a lot more successful than Matter of Life and Death.
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah,
but nonetheless, there is that sort of did everyone in Alpha talk to the cosmic intelligence? Could they all read each other's minds? Did they all get old? Because at one point at the end, Paul says it was weird or wild or amazing or something like that.
Yeah, well, it'd be nice to know what everybody else experienced. But you know, Martin Landau is the star. Barry Morris is one of the. You know, I think he's third. Third ranking star on and after Barbara Bain. So I can understand why you'd want to focus on those two. And as you've pointed out, and maybe this was something that was very deliberate by the writers, you know, that you've got Koenig who has, you know, the very doom and gloom. I mean, he really is the pessimist.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I would necessarily call Bergman as the optimist, but he's the one with the scientific hope. So
yeah,
there's an interesting dichotomy now that exists between the two of them. And to see these two alone together as they're facing this massive unknown is a very compelling moment.
Yeah. I mean, yes. It is an interesting experience. A bit of, again, like the aging, a bit derivative from 2001's equally nonsensical bit of an ending there, but yeah, it works better than Matter and Life and Death. It's still,
and the fact that with Matter of Life and Death, the problem here is that that is taking place in the known universe, and it's dealing with how long has the theory of antimatter been around by the time we got to that episode?
Well, at least as long as Star Trek.
I mean, yeah, I know,
it's been a physical property. I'm reasonably sure we could probably track it back to Einstein. You know,
I'm sure we probably could. So the whole concept of, in fact, I even think they say it in that episode how, you know, matter, antimatter, touch, boom, bad idea.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's
so we are dealing with established scientific theories at the very least. And what we're getting is something that strays so far off the mark. And with this one, what saves it is that it's dealing with the biggest mystery of mysteries in terms of the cosmos. And that is what's inside a black hole. What do you experience if you get inside the black hole? And though they're able to use the pretense of the anti-grav shield that will protect them and not tear them to shreds from the intense gravity. If you can assume that you would actually survive going past the event horizon going inside, wow, I mean, what are the possibilities? I mean, we've heard scientists say how physics completely breaks down inside a black hole. And so now this gives them the opportunity to really kind of go trippy, but it's done in a rather believable sort of – I don't want to say believable sort of way. I mean, I think the audience as a rule will kind of give it some form of a hand wave because we know it's inside a black hole and all bets are off at this point. So it works.
Yeah.
How well it works, I think, will depend on the viewer.
Yeah, I think
– I mean, like for me, I was really intrigued with the idea of – you know, the cosmic intelligence, a being that was so enormously vast. You know, I'm not going to call it God. I'm not going to say that. In fact, I would like to believe that it's just some passive being that observes. I don't like the idea of it having interfered with their lives. I mean, that
somebody moved the eagle.
I know.
You know, if they had just passed through that black hole, black sun, and pulled out the other side, then you could be left with, was that a hallucination? Did the shield actually protect them?
And
that stuff is clear, but when the eagle returns,
that's the part that really gets weird. How did the eagle get back there?
It had to be true.
Yeah.
To some degree, some agency had to do that. Now, one thing I do really like is the Bergman and Koenig are mind-thinking back at each other and mutually admiring their unified field theories. And Koenig is kind of looking at the little spots, which I guess are supposed to be the stars, and he says something to the effect of, the stars are just the cells in the brain of the universe. And that's the moment the cosmic intelligence decides to hop in. What a lovely way of thinking about it. It's kind of an interesting notion that in just this sort of moment, in this moment, as these people are passing through this realm where they can communicate, or they could, in theory, communicate with this cosmic intelligence, which normally they could not because of the physical laws of the universe preventing them, that it's actually something, it's listening. This thing is listening
to
what they're saying. It's aware. It's listening to them. And it's not saying anything until Koenig says something interesting that it thinks is lovely. It's a concept that it latches onto. And I don't want to say pretty, but it is appealing to them. And that's what triggers it to initiate contact.
Yeah, but also
just let them pass through and not say a word. But it's a lovely idea.
Yeah. But it also tells them that, you know, it lives on such an enormously grand scale that every thought is 1,000 years.
Right. After Bergman asks it a question.
Right.
Why have I never talked to you before? So wow, you arrogant little. Like, why have you not talked?
Why have you not talked? You know, well,
have you been in a black hole before, Bergman?
Yeah. Well, that's the point. The black hole, because the physical laws so break down, it allows for them to talk to this cosmic thing. That's the only way. Because time breaks down, or as Koenig said, time turned inside out. It was that space was the only way that they could communicate with whatever that cosmic intelligence is. Otherwise, I mean, I'm sure it heard them. I'm sure it was aware of them, but it just couldn't talk to them. Not in a way that it could. Not in a way that they could hear.
So, yeah, I think it's interesting that they're kind of, in a way, if you could look at it as saying that humanity actually did present something interesting to it.
Yeah.
Like, it observed us and it saw something, just a little glimmer, like a flower on a snowy day where just the first little flower peeks out or something, and you look at it, it's like, oh, that's lovely. That's kind of the feel I get out of it as it goes through. But this should have been the second episode. They could have solved so many problems.
By shooting it on the far side of at least the galaxy. But they do say the universe, don't they?
Yeah, they do. But
yeah, that would have answered a lot of problems right there on the spot.
Battlestar Galactica has a lot of problems with that. And I mean proper Battlestar Galactica in the beginning. It was like, oh, we're going into another galaxy with four planets this time. It's like,
yeah,
solar system, you idiot. Solar system. So I think he did say across
the universe.
Their
science is very bad.
They were shot an incredible distance. We don't know what speed they're traveling anymore. We don't know how far in the future or how far in the past they are anymore. And if they had done that right after blasting out of Earth's orbit and encountered this in a shot across the universe, then you know, a lot of the complaints that people, again, level at it. It's like, how would it get to planets? There aren't any out there. There's not, you know, it may have put you in a place where there's, it may have put them somewhere intentionally.
It might very well have.
It may have put them on a path to a destiny that they have. We don't know. But because we don't know what really happened in the Black Sun, was a natural phenomena, or whether it was because the survival ship got transferred back to them. So therefore, we can assume that, you know, maybe it shot them towards a planet. Yeah, that's a nice little planet your moon would be good at. You know, we'll point you in that direction. Don't know. Or maybe it's more of a generalist. It's like, well, I put you over where there's a bunch of planets, and maybe you'll find one you like. You know, as opposed to a specific destiny, but more of like, well, I'm giving you a little push out into the deeper waters where there's stuff. I don't know. I don't know if we'll ever see it again. Will he fall through another black sun and talk to the intelligence again? Not that it gave them any answers, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Right. And that's Space 1999 for you in a nutshell.
That's pretty much it. Yes.
I think that's about it. So, Ben, thank you for joining me.
A pleasure as always.
And listeners, I do hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Leave us a review on iTunes or stop by and visit us at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fusionpatrol. Our Twitter username is @FusionPatrol, or you can just send us a comment at feedback@FusionPatrol.com. Come check out our new YouTube channel at youtube.com/FusionPatrol. Please, come join the conversation. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.